Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. How are you, Lucy?
I'm fine, thanks, Alex. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. I'm so relieved to be at home. I was away at the weekend and on my way back to Ireland, Storm Kathleen had her way with me.
She got you, did she?
She really did get me.
Oh, dear.
And I thought I might never go home. And then when I did get home, I had to put the buckets out under the leaky roof.
So I was going to say, you did still have a roof when you got home.
Just about. I think we're a deck chair down, but that's the way it goes. But I'm relieved to be here. And we have much to talk about this week, including a bumper week for fans of Byron in the Times Literary Supplement.
It absolutely is, because it's 200 years since his death. So we've got all sorts of things. We've got a review of two new, I think, sort of biographies or studies of his life. We've got a consideration of what happened at the centenary of his death. We've got two new letters and also a review of a book about the ways in which Byron and Jane Austen intersected or didn't.
Or did they?
Yeah, exactly. I see. Yeah, so there's a lot going on.
I myself have been delving into Byron in the shape of a book that I think is one of the books under review in this week's paper, Byron's Travels, Poems, Letters and Journals, which is selected and introduced by Fiona Stafford. And I don't know how it is that sometimes when you flop open a book at a certain point, it just seems to really speak to you. It's wonderful. Literary serendipity. Mm-hmm. But this is a little, and I thought I might read it out, Lucy, in case
Please
we
do.
Ever, we, you know, you and I are often saying, oh, just now we sit at home, don't we, and watch stuff on telly that we perhaps shouldn't watch.
And we hear about everyone else travelling the world.
Exactly. But shouldn't we be out and about in literary London? However, Byron writes one day, last night, he says, party in italics at Lansdowne House. Tonight, party in italics at Lady Charlotte Greville's. Deplorable waste of time and something of temper. Nothing imparted, nothing acquired, talking without ideas. If anything like thought in my mind, it was not on the subjects on which we were gabbling. Hey-ho, and in this way, half London pass what is called life. Tomorrow, there is Lady Heathcote's. Shall I go? Yes, to punish myself for not having a pursuit. Now, if that is not a good reason, Byron is telling us to stay home.
It's like Byron's cure for FOMO, isn't it?
Exactly. Byron didn't believe in FOMO. But the problem is, in the next paragraph, he kind of undoes all his good work in persuading us that we shouldn't go out, or perhaps he's just persuading us he's really very, very good at describing people. He's talking about a young lady that he meets who people say is not pretty, but he finds her rather pretty. And he says, there is that shyness of the antelope. And I thought, you have to be a really good poet to come up with a description like that, don't you?
Or a very good natural observer.
Yes, that shyness of the antelope, Lucy. Mm. Now, we are going to hope very much that our guests today are not shy like antelopes or any other beasts, because we do have a packed programme. We take a long day's journey into the West End in the company of George Berridge. And fiction editor Toby Lichtig joins us to unravel the curious history of Malian novelist Yambo Ulugwem.
But first, there's a new production on in London at the moment, which has caused quite a stir with its star casting and its reputation as one of the classics of 20th century theatre. I'm talking about Eugene O'Neill's celebrated tragedy, Long Day's Journey Into Night, with Brian Cox and Patricia Clarkson as the father and mother of the Tyrone family. Our own George Berridge, the editor of American Literature at the TLS, went along and wrote about it for us. And we are very happy that he's here to talk it through with us. George, I know you're very, very busy today. So thank you for taking time out to talk about this with us.
Well, I can certainly always make time for the TLS podcast.
Well, that's a lovely and correct answer. But so in your piece, which told me lots of fascinating stuff I ought to know, because I'm pretty sure I did Long Day's Journey for one of my A-level texts, I now think. But I didn't know most of the stuff that you said in the piece. You tell us about the backstory of the play and how very autobiographical it is. Can you kind of talk us through it a bit?
Yes, I can. I mean, like his hero in many regards, Strindberg, O'Neill writes very, very autobiographically, and Long Day's Journey is the most kind of powerful example of this. It is largely based, so far as anyone knows, it's really just the family name is changed, obviously Tyrone with a slightly Irish association. But yes, no, it tells basically the story of the family in one day in August 1912, as they reconvene, as they did every summer, at their summer home in Connecticut. So it features the father, James Tyrone, who is modeled after very closely to O'Neill's father, James O'Neill, who was an aspiring and hopeful actor, certainly hoped to be a kind of famed Shakespearean, but who ended up on rotation making a lot of money playing Edmond Dantès in a touring production of The Count of Monte Cristo.
So I was just also very delighted to hear that their family home that they were in at that point is called Monte Cristo Cottage.
It is, that's correct. They actually do, it's now a museum, I think, for Eugene O'Neill, and I believe they do productions occasionally at the cottage, which I imagine might be somewhere between quite moving and quite eerie to go and see.
And the play itself, so he wrote it very late, didn't he? And then he said, this is not to be published until 25 years after my death, but that's not quite what happened.
Yes, that's true. O'Neill had several reasons for not wanting the play to be published during his lifetime, though I didn't go into this in my review so much. But during the 40s, O'Neill had become very, very interested in what was happening in Europe during the war, and didn't feel that particularly a play like Long Day's Journey would be understood or would be appropriate for an audience just coming out of the Second World War. But of course, other factors went into this, in that the play was very, very deeply personal and touched on some very, very sore subjects for him. But yes, no, the story was that he gave this over to his editors at Random House and trusted it to their vaults there. And you can read his kind of direct instructions to his publisher in his letters. But after he died, not long after, his wife, Carlotta, with whom he had had a slightly difficult relationship, they kind of separated on a number of occasions, and they had a slightly difficult relationship, but not long after he died, she went to Random House, and she knew about the play already. He'd written about the play in letters and spoken about it, and indeed dedicated the play to her for the 12th wedding anniversary. But then she decided that it should be published and it should be broadcast, and then when Random House put up a fight, which they did, his publisher said no, we'd really like to respect Eugene O'Neill's wishes. She said, well, about that, and then provided them with some legal reasons that they had absolutely no case, no leg to stand on. And she went ahead and published it anyway with a university press. And then that was it. Cat was out of the bag.
Mm. And you talk about the production history of the play. It has quite a starry past in Britain, doesn't it?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. It's been one of the first kind of big star to play the character of James as Laurence Olivier. But as I say in the piece, you go through Timothy West and Charles Dance and David Suchet, Jeremy Irons quite recently, who also played the role at Wyndham's last time it was there, and Mary, his wife, and Eugene O'Neill's mother, Prunella Scales, Jessica Lange, Vanessa Redgrave, Leslie Manville. And what I didn't get a chance to mention, though, I watched it over the weekend, and I encourage listeners to go and watch it. I think it's probably available on YouTube and elsewhere, is the terrific 1962 film version with Katharine Hepburn playing Mary, which is it's a really astonishing performance, and really it's very, very moving and very, very unsettling towards the end, but it's certainly worth digging out.
Mm-hmm. Alex, I believe you have something to share with the group here at this point.
Well, I do have something to share with you, which is that I saw it when I was 18. With Jack Lemmon in it.
Did you?
I did. You see, stick with me, George. If you're this old, you've seen stuff.
And how was he? Was he good?
Well, I think the thing is, I was 18. So what I just remember it being very, very long. That's appalling of me, isn't it?
Not at all. Who was, do you remember who played his wife, Mary?
I do not.
Right.
I'm so sorry.
He was the memorable one.
He was completely the memorable one, of course, exactly. And this is Jonathan Miller's production, I think.
Right. I bet it was good.
It was very good.
Yes.
I think perhaps it wasn't quite where I was at the time.
No, I can imagine that actually. Yes, I can imagine that seeing it later in life, it would probably hit harder, actually. I mean, it hits pretty hard anyway, but yeah, I think it probably hits harder the older you get. So there's always been quite a lot riding on these productions, hasn't there? There's a kind of weight of history and performance, do you think, George?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, yeah, as you say, that it comes with a very, very long kind of storied history, but for the actors and indeed the director working with it, it comes the way of trying to recreate and tell such a personal story. This is a very difficult play to watch in places, not just as you point out, Alex, because in some productions it can be quite an intimidating length. It can go up to 4 hours, which was
more
standard in years gone by, but it has been cut down, and now it sort of hovers at around 3.5 hours, which still for most theatregoers, it's a fairly long time to stay in your seat. Although I wonder whether perhaps audiences now, with the rising length of kind of blockbuster films, I wonder whether they're more accustomed to sitting there in their seats for 3 hours.
Maybe. And actually, there is someone from a well-known TV programme, isn't there now? I mean, not just TV. Of course, he's done lots of wonderful things, but as you point out, he's most known for his TV. So it's Brian Cox as James Tyrone and Patricia Clarkson as Mary. And so, as I say, he is the best known at the moment, isn't he? How are they?
Well, I would say so, yes. It's lucky, and as I point out in my review, the last time I saw Brian Cox on stage was, I believe, with my parents, was 10 years ago, almost to the day, which was at Wyndham's as well. In a very, very spooky production of Conor McPherson's The Weir.
I think I saw that too. It was terrific.
It was terrific. Opposite Ardla Hamlin,
his
young Jim, which was, it's a very creeping story. It begins kind of in this barroom in Ireland and just becomes more and more and more unsettling the longer it goes on. Not too dissimilar to A Long Day's Journey Into Night, in which
yes.
Brian Cox is he's good. There are some issues with the play, as it goes forward. And I think that one of the early stumbling points is that the pacing of the play is very, very peculiar. And given that it is such a intimidating role to take on, just for the sheer amount of dialogue that needs to be remembered for it, that Cox, though he starts in kind of jocular and avuncular but slightly brittle form, which is, I think, as the role should be. But what you never get a sense of from him, and I sense that, is there a sense that there's a moment to pause and a moment to reflect in between lines? And what ends up happening is that certainly the night that I saw it, there were a few kind of fumbles or slight hesitancies, not real kind of slippages in line, but just moments where clearly the word very, very briefly eluded him. But I think this comes down to the decision to cut down the play's running time, which does mean that the first act particularly ends up feeling very, very pacey, and where you want to be trying to establish the atmosphere between the characters and between the family is one of kind of brittle functioning. But what ends up happening is that particularly Cox is forced into a position where he has to speak quite quickly and run into other people's lines almost the moment they finished. And this slightly takes some of the weight out of the things that he's trying to say, I think. So it's not necessarily that he is at fault in the particularly in the first two acts, but that just the character and shaping of the play this time around aren't necessarily the best suited for his abilities.
Yeah, I mean, having said exactly, you know, having said that, I've obviously blocked out some of the memory of going to see it as a teenager. I do nonetheless remember it silences, the sort of fraught silences between the family members being incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's right. I think silence should really be kind of, I know this feels very slightly cliche, but it should be a kind of additional character in the play. Given that this is it's a play so given over to the ghosts of the past, and where everything is so tentative that the entire first half of the play is structured largely around the desire of James not to break to Mary fully that their son has consumption, is going to need to go off to a sanatorium as Eugene O'Neill did. And this trying to walk around the subject, and he kind of says things like, well, the doctor thinks it might be a touch of something else as well as this summer cold. And it's this very, very tense atmosphere as he combats not just to kind of hide this information or delay this information getting to Mary in a more concrete way, but how he interacts with his other son, Jamie, and how they have differing views over whether or not to tell his mother and how to handle his mother's nerves over the subject. And as you say, there should be moments where that's left to kind of sting the audience a little bit, so as to realize the kind of the weight of what these people are trying to balance. And it's just never quite given over to the audience in this, particularly in the first half of this production.
You make a really good point in your piece about the books within the play, about what the characters read or have read and what's important to them, which this set design doesn't seem to want to sort of acknowledge so much, does it?
No, I mean, set design being what it can be called, that it's very, very pared back. It's very, very minimal. And I was reading in the director's notes in the programme the other day that his case being that the pared back staging would kind of give the audience the chance to really focus on what's happening between these characters. But I think that's a rather ungenerous interpretation of how an audience spends their time watching a play. And particularly in other productions of the play, there's a very, very good one on YouTube with Alfred Molina in the main role. The house is supposed to be one of kind of which is supposed to bear the weight of the men's learning, that it's supposed to be dressed out with kind of books that they've read and reread, because they're constantly, the boys and the father are constantly quoting in it, obviously the father particularly from Shakespeare. And there are little moments where he brings up with the boys times that he's made them memorize Shakespeare for bets. And then when there's a moment where he's talking about, well, I've got three volumes of the complete works in there, and he's kind of gesturing towards these kind of bare empty walls. Just doesn't quite stack up. It feels like an unnecessary paring back, and one that doesn't necessarily help the audience understand anything of the character of the family or who these people are, but gives the audience very little to look at throughout. It's very dressed down, and I think doesn't particularly add anything to the performance.
I was interested in what you said about the audience reaction, because it seemed to me that it was pretty uneasy, certainly for the first act or so, and that the audience didn't quite kind of know where things were supposed to land, whether it was sad, whether it was supposed to be funny, that kind of thing, which happens quite a lot, I think. And I always think that that's someone not having the confidence, unless they mean for that to be the case. It's someone, possibly the director, I don't know, not having the confidence to sort of trust to the material. I mean, that's my theory, for what it's worth. But do you think it found its centre? Did it settle? Did the audience kind of, was there a moment when you think, okay, we're all in this, we know what's going on?
Yes, I think so. As I said in my review, it was a very, very odd atmosphere at times during the first act, because the real tension develops very, very early. You know, it starts in this kind of very upbeat way with James and Mary joking around just after having finished breakfast. But the tension is supposed to set in very, very quickly. And the way that O'Neill writes the play, it's not necessarily a play that is designed to be easy viewing for the theatre goers. Certainly there are moments of comic relief. There are moments where there are several factors where, yeah, there are things that are like jokes, but it's always supposed to be quite uneasy. There's never supposed to be a sense that this is kind of a laugh out loud moment, other than perhaps a couple of little bits involving their maid Kathleen. But certainly towards the end of the play, it does find its footing a little bit. The first act, the first two acts, as I said, just to me seemed too rushed, and it meant that at certain points, lines that should be given in a kind of slightly serious or bitter way, or kind of a slightly more mixed way, end up just getting received completely as jokes. And it was very interesting to see how the audience was split over that. So there are a few real a few real bellows from a few people, and then a few others kind of looking at those who had bellowed with sort of bemused expressions. Towards the end, it does settle down. And this is partly down to the fact that towards the end, the characters are given given monologues in a more dedicated way. And there are some very, very moving moments in the second half. There's a card game between James and his younger son, Edmund, which is really, really, really very, very moving. I think kind of the strongest moment of the play. But by the time that the play has drawn to its climax and Mary, who is a very, very troubled and very, very tragic morphine addict who's had something close to a true collapse, the collapse that they've all been dreading, and she comes downstairs and she is kind of lost in reverie thinking about her time in convent school and her marriage and her early days with James. And you could hear, you really could hear a pin drop by the end of it. It's very, very, and she sits down just on the edge of the stage and kind of gazes out at what the audience knows to be kind of the encircling fog as the night draws in. It's really quite a poignant end, and it really saved in my memory, certainly the ending of the play. Not that it kind of completely erased what I thought were the blunders in the first half, but I certainly left feeling that the second act had achieved what it set out to do.
It's really interesting you mentioned, because that, you know, across the fog of time is really the bit that I remember. I remember it almost coming as a sort of shock when this woman appears in the production that I saw, which incidentally, I felt so abashed by not knowing who played that role. I just have, while we've been talking, have looked it up. It was Bethel Leslie. But what I also discover is that the younger son in that production that I saw all those years ago was Kevin Spacey.
Oh, gosh.
I know. Ooh. And gets a rather good review in Blake Morrison's review of the time. But
right.
There we are. That's it. What I feel this is all telling me is that I have to give it another shot.
Yes, I mean, I would say so. I think it's quite a short run at Wyndham's, but it's worth going to see, I think. I think that even though I think there are problems with this production, it's still interesting. There's still, I didn't come away thinking, oh, well, you know, I regret spending three hours at the theatre for that. It always gives you something to think about, I think, the ways that directors choose to interpret this kind of deep personal play. And so for its failings, I think it's worth seeing still.
Well, that's a wonderful kind of dive into it, George. Thank you so much for talking us through it.
Not at all.
Still to come on the show, Toby Lischtig joins us to delve into a tragic literary scandal.
And to read all the pieces we talk about and much more, remember to subscribe to the TLS. Just head on over to our website at the-tls.co.uk.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Now, accusations of plagiarism crop up repeatedly throughout literary history. And the question is always the same. When does a borrowing become a copy? In this week's issue, there's a review by Tobias Warner of Yango Ulugrem's 1968 novel Bound to Violence, which met exactly this fate and meant that the author never published another book. But it's a rather more complex episode than first glances suggest. And here to unpick it is fiction editor Toby Lichtig. Toby, welcome to help us through this, as I said, very complex literary scandal.
Thank you, Alex. Lovely to be back. And I will do my best to walk you through. So basically, a young Malian novelist called Yango Ulugrem brought out this book, as you say, called Bound to Violence, or Le Devoir de Violence, in the late 60s in 1968. It met with great acclaim very quickly. It won the Prix Renaudot, which is a very prestigious prize, and translated into English relatively soon after that, and was well-reviewed in the States, relatively well-reviewed in the UK. And then something happened in the TLS, I'm afraid. In 1972, the TLS published an unsigned piece called Something New Out of Africa, in which the author compared a passage from Graham Greene's book It's a Battlefield, his early book from the 1930s, with a passage from Ulugrem's Bound to Violence, and it being the TLS at the time, the passage from Ulugrem was entirely in French and the Greene passage was entirely in English. They were quite similar for those who could speak both languages. It would have been quite obvious. And then there was a small, slightly snippy write-up beneath, basically imputing plagiarism. It was slightly more nuanced than that. It did say something along the lines of, you know, perhaps this was deliberate or perhaps he's being playful, but it basically said, hey, look, we've caught you out. This is a massive piece of plagiarism. On the back of that, Graham Greene's US publishers threatened to sue the French publishers of Ulugrem's book. There was a big scandal. It was withdrawn from publication. And then even more tragically, as will become clear, the author basically having, you know, been feted in Paris prison literary circles, you know, he was living in Paris at the time, I believe, or at least spending a lot of time there. He basically slunk back to Mali and never, as you said in the beginning, never published another book. And that was really the end of his literary career. I think he wrote a handful of short stories, but that was it, really. He withdrew from literary life and he died not very long ago in 2017. It's a very sad story, as an editor of TLS.
I know, exactly. Can I just say, I read this as well and felt awful.
You know, we haven't always got it right, the TLS.
No, but
famously damned Ulysses, but Joyce recovered. But unfortunately, this... Ulugrem did not. And we should say as well, it's, you know, plagiarism is plagiarism, or borrowing is borrowing, perhaps. The whole point of this book has become clear from our piece, and this was also previously debated in France, it should be said, was that this is a book of borrowings. The author draws not just on Graham Greene, he draws on James Baldwin, on Raymond Chandler, Paul Prillet, on Maupassant, Flaubert, Old Testament, New Testament, various Arabic chronicles. And one of the points about this book is it's about colonialism and it's about plunder. Ah, yes, we can see what he's doing here. And what's so intriguing to me about this story is that in a way, it seems like a fight wasn't put up. I don't really know, perhaps maybe some of our listeners will do. I don't really know why the publishers of Greene managed to put enough pressure on the French publishers for the book to be withdrawn. I don't know why a greater case wasn't made for the fact that this wasn't plagiarism. This was deliberate riffing. This was deliberate borrowing. Mm. And I don't know why Ulugrem kind of put his hands up and went back to Mali. I guess, you know, this is a climate of racism, suspicion of African authors. Perhaps he just didn't feel like he had enough power to fight the racist literary world at the time. I don't know, but I feel like there's another greater story here that I'm not entirely aware of, and I'm not sure if anyone is, but I would be very interested to hear if anyone knows more about.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
do please tell us if anyone knows.
Absolutely. I found myself in Tobias Warner's piece of sort of reading between the lines, and there were kind of two particular lines. One was, you know, as you've said, it was Graham Greene's US publisher, Greene, huge American publishers, presumably with legal departments,
yes,
happy to spend hours and hours proving their cases. But it also, there was a little sketch, really, of the kind of rivalry in French publishing. He'd been published by Le Seuil, hadn't he, in France. And it was the French publisher, Paul Flammond, who was essentially accused by another publisher and great rival, Gallimard, of publishing a plagiarist. And you can imagine that sort of power game within French publishing might have had something to do with it as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Although it sounds like they kept that argument to themselves. So, you know, there were people who were writing to Flammond saying, wait a sec, I've seen a bit of Maupassant in this novel. I've seen a bit of Flaubert here. There was a letter Gallimard wrote to Flammond. In fact, I don't know if it was to Flammond, but it was a letter he wrote, a private letter, basically kind of pouring scorn on the award of a prize to this book. But it was more kind of internal book chat. No one was trying to, you know, out, in inverted commas, this author. No one was accusing him publicly of plagiarism. They were just sort of being a bit scornful and a bit mocking. And I imagine there was a great deal of racism, you know, flowing beneath that mockery, or, you know, maybe even less subtle than that, perhaps. But it was really, it was the TLS that blew the lid, as it were.
Yes, well, yes, that's our part.
It does feel nice to have at least rehabilitated him to a certain extent to be running this piece, you know, over 50 years later.
A bit late. We're a bit late.
Sorry, everyone. Yeah. But, you know, at least with a tiny repayment to the debt. Anyway.
I have a feeling that the French literary world, I think, still is and probably was pretty slow to litigate as well about books. I think much, much slower than the States. And it still is. Do you remember the seventh function of...
Laurent Binet.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Seventh function of language. Which I think if you had published it over here or in the States, because it involved a lot of people who are still alive or some people who haven't been dead that long.
Yes.
And it was
French literary theorists, wasn't it?
Yes, it was about literary theorists.
Could you just tell me a bit about that, Lucy? Because I don't know this story and maybe some of our listeners don't.
It's a wonderful book. It's about a sort of detective. I read it ages ago, so I'm going to remember this wrongly, but it's about the detective on the trail of a set of literary theorists who turn out to be kind of extraordinary set of people who get up to all sorts of weird and also kind of quite disgusting things. Quite
but
a lot of them.
It also includes Derrida, includes Foucault, Lacan, and some who were still living at the time. And you're right, it puts them in all sorts of strange scenarios.
It really does.
Know, it's and basically, they... you know, libelous, you know, in some climates.
Well, This is all coming back to me now. This is a book by Laurence Binet, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Laurence Binet. Yes. And it was particularly, some of it was aimed at Philippe Solaire, who was... I think he's still alive. I can't remember.
Yes. He certainly was at the time. I think he is now.
And Philippe Solaire was can we say, he was not delighted by this because he was pretty severely sort of lampooned, but there wasn't any legal action because it's just a very different climate, I think.
Exactly. In certain places it would have been, but I guess, yeah.
So I think maybe there was the same, it was the same sort of thing in the case. There's a lot of talk. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of kind of fierce debate and name calling and things like that. But I get the feeling that they're very slow to litigate anyway.
And it's only when you then get the letter from the American publisher threatening a lawsuit that things change. But it is, I mean, as we've said, it's intriguing because these things are always intriguing, aren't they? And I was saying at the beginning, you know, these are the kind of things that literary circles, you know, thrive on, these kind of accusations and defences of plagiarism. But it is a terrible story. And it also had to do, as Tobias Warner's piece tells us, with Yambo Ulugwem's own determination not to be typecast as this writer of what was called an authentic African novel. He didn't want to be doing it. In fact, he wanted to write about that. Yep. He wanted to reflect that in his novel. But then, as we're seeing, it didn't
he
do
got shut down.
Good. He got shut down.
Yeah.
Another tiny irony, even at the brief period when it was being feted before the kind of plagiarism row, it was celebrated as, I quote, this is a translation from the quote in Le Monde, but it says the first truly African novel. And in fact, I think what Le Monde actually said was something like the first African novel worthy of its name. So even then.
Yeah. What they mean is the first African novel I've read.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But even when his whole point was to kind of, you know, draw on the kind of global literary history to not be typecast as an African novel. He was still being, even in celebration, he was being celebrated. And what's, of course, what's particularly upsetting about this, it completely takes away any discussion of the book itself, which, yes, which sounds exactly wonderful.
So let's write that. Toby, tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, I'm going to, I must say, I haven't read it yet, but I'm going, so I'm going on to Barnes & Warner's review, but I'll read you a little excerpt that kind of sums it up quite nicely. So it's a century-spanning epic set in a fictional African kingdom called Nakem, which has been ruled since the Middle Ages by a hereditary dynasty. And although the book's nominally about this dynasty and it's a sort of a family saga, its real focus is on the long-suffering populace of Nakem, caught between the machinations of the repressive family and a series of hapless colonial governors. So it's about leadership, it's about colonialism, it's about politics, and it's about, you know, it's about plunder. And it sounds fascinating. I mean, you know, everything about this piece makes me desperate to go off and read it and write another wrong.
When was it? It was 1968.
Yes.
It sounds pretty kind of boundary pushing for 1968.
Yeah,
that sounds,
yeah,
like absolutely. a new and exciting thing to have been doing. And you can't help thinking, if it had been presented by a white Parisian author, would everyone have just said, "This is the most wonderful bit of collage I've ever seen"?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And perhaps he or she would have felt empowered to, you know, reply to this TLS. You know, Flamand did actually write a letter to the TLS defending the book. You know, but as far as I can see, that was the kind of sum of the defence. But, you know, exactly, perhaps in different circumstances and by a, you know, by a white author at the time, there would have been a whole different defence.
It made me think a little bit about, I mean, this is, again, something that's been discussed over many years. But you mentioned that the piece was anonymous, the piece was unsigned. Now, that was what happened. I mean, all TLS reviews of the time were unsigned, weren't they?
Yeah,
it wasn't that this was a sort of we're doing this one specially so that you can't, you know,
can't
keep the receipts. It wasn't that. But of course, it does then bring in the whole ethics of critics who won't go, you know, who won't put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, and I did some digging. So pieces are unsigned, I believe, until 1973. And more recently, this century, someone or some people went through our entire archive and put names to all those formerly unsigned reviews. So the vast bulk of the pieces between 1902 and 1973, which were formerly unsigned, we knew who they were. You know, there were payment patterns and all the rest of it. You know, there was an archive. However, this one, it remains unsigned. I haven't been able to find out who wrote it. I'm wondering whether it was an internal job, because the write-up itself is actually quite short. The bulk of the piece, it's like a page, is just comparing these two passages. So I'm wondering whether someone internally thought it would be fun. I don't know. But, you know, there's enough cultural memory at this paper to try and find out, but I haven't as yet. Found out. And there was actually, we'll come to it, there was an exchange of letters in the paper a couple of years ago about this scandal for reasons that in a second will become apparent. And one of the letter writers said, if anyone knows who wrote this piece, please come, you know, please come and tell us. But no one has yet. Mm. So that remains a mystery.
Mm. And it's come to reissue now, hasn't it? Partly because of Yambo Ulugwem's daughter.
Yeah, so she has been putting pressure, I'm told, on the French publishing industry to reissue it. And that's the main reason it got reissued there. But there's also another lovely part of this story, which is that a few years ago, in fact, 3 years ago, another Francophone African writer, not from Mali, but from Senegal, called Mohamed Ngar Sarr, wrote a novel translated into English as The Most Secret Memory of Men, which essentially features an Ulugwem-style novelist and an Ulugwem-style scandal, which kind of reignited people's interests in Bound to Violence. And this book, La Plus Secrète Mémoire des Hommes, with apologies for anyone who actually speaks French, unlike me, won the Prix Goncourt in 2021. So it's rather a wonderful story, this book about this scandal. I mean, it's not directly about it. It riffs on it. The author in this case is actually Senegalese rather than Malian. He wrote his book, which was called The Labyrinth, in the 1930s. And it's about the kind of chase for this missing book and this missing author. But it's essentially based around Ulugwem's story. And yes, it went on to, you know, sell half a million copies and win a major, major prize and renew interest in Bound to Violence. So it's a really lovely addendum to the story, as it were.
It's interesting that you, Toby, and obviously by brilliant editorial design, have reviews of both of these books next to one another.
Well, exactly.
In the paper. And as you were saying, I mean, it really does make you want to go and read Yambo Ulugwem's novel. Same can't quite be said of The Most Secret Memory of Men, can it, according to your reviewer?
According to Michael Lapointe, my reviewer, he's written a very, very nice piece, and he contextualises it all very nicely, and he makes, you know, he makes a case for the interest in this book by Saar. And it does sound fun, you know, this sort of the hunt for the missing author theme. And again, it's this book is also about plunder and, you know, it kind of contains stories within stories. But in the end, I think he finds, I mean, obviously he's reading it in translation, but he finds the language a little sort of forced and a little too full of, what do you say, unwieldy metaphors and airy ambiguities. And he has an interesting take on its treatment of women. So basically, this is a book sort of full of authors and ideas of authorship, and basically it seems that every time a female author arrives on the scene, she ends up, anytime one of the male authors meets a female author, he just immediately ends up sleeping with her, and all the female authors seem to be objectified. Even at the end, there's a line about the Argentinian Silvina and Victoria Ocampo, and there's an idea about sort of someone sleeping with them at the same time. It does feel a little bad taste, some of that. I don't know how much that was talked about in the French press. I mean, you know, it did win this prize, so I don't know whether people were objecting. Go on, Lucy, perhaps you can enlighten us.
No, I was just going to say, I don't know about that, actually, and I haven't really read a bit about that, but I have read a bit of the book. I haven't managed to finish it yet. And it's a bit like reading the piece about Ulugwem. It slightly makes for uncomfortable reading because it's pretty sharp about the literary scene, actually. And you know that you know the guy gets a bit of minor success, and suddenly he's the new young voice to watch out for, which is pretty much exactly what they said about this guy when he won the Goncourt. He's very young to win the Goncourt, and also there's a 2021, the first Francophone writer from sub-Saharan Africa to win it as well. I think
that's amazing in 2021. It's kind of, as you say, it's kind of, I mean, amazing is one word anyway.
Yes, it's amazing in lots of senses. And he's sort of writing about the literary scene and how that's portrayed. So I haven't got as far as, it's interesting to read that about the attitude towards women. I haven't got as far as that yet, but I found it pretty sharp, actually,
as a literary satire.
Yeah. Yes.
In that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, we are left, aren't we, really, though, thinking, gosh, what might Yambo Ulugwem have done with his career had it not had this terrible, and I imagine incredibly traumatic, stop put to it, just
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. Whereas at least, you know, as you say, Saar is 34, no one's accusing him of plagiarism, and hopefully he will go on to have, you know, the glittering career that was denied to Ulugwem.
And we'll just mention, just as a very find that you've got reviews of three novels in this week's paper, haven't you? Also, Jennifer Croft's new novel is the third, and of course she's a translator too, isn't she? And now a novelist.
I'm afraid I couldn't resist this little spread. I do like to make the spread thematic. So it's nothing to do with the sub-Saharan African literary scene or the Parisian literary scene.
Well, actually, though, it is, because of the Roberto Bolaño thing.
Well, it is a bit, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Were you just going to say that?
Well, I was going to say, it is a novel about the hunt for a missing author. So it draws on a lot of the similar theme. I have read this novel, The Extinction of Irina Ray, by Jennifer Croft, and I can say it's brilliant. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was so funny and so clever. And very, very briefly, it's a story in which this group of translators converges on a forest to hunker down with their author, as they call her, our author. She's this kind of incredibly erudite and celebrated Polish novelist, clearly modelled on Olga Tokarczuk, who, in fact, Jennifer Croft translates from the Polish into English when she's in her translator's guise. And basically, they all hang out with her. There's this sort of pact that whenever she brings out a new novel, they all hang out with her. They can't talk to the outside world, and they sort of translate it behind closed doors, as it were. But this time, this novelist behaves incredibly erratically, does some very strange things, and then disappears. And the rest of the novel is about the search for her and the manuscript that she may or may not have left behind. And it's about a gazillion other things that I couldn't possibly even begin to go into in depth, you know, in a brief... brief few minutes on a podcast, but it's to do with ecology and mushrooms and the task of the translator. And it's very, very, it's one of those books where you sit there reading and chuckling away and just feeling that you are in the sort of aura of a superior intelligence, not in a kind of annoying way, but just in a kind of really wonderful way. And very, very briefly, one of the conceits is the book we're reading is itself a translation. So one of the translators has written this memoir or this kind of account of the, you know, their search for the missing author, but another of the translators has translated this from Spanish into English, and the two translators hate each other. They're massive Brilliant. Rivals. And so it's full of very kind of Nabokovian style footnotes in which the translator of the supposed text we have in our hands kind of adds little snippy asides.
Oh, you're playing my tune now, Toby. You're telling me it's a book about, it's books within books.
Yes.
It's a missing person.
Yes.
And there's footnotes.
Yes. All those things.
I mean, I'm kind of sold, really. Yeah,
it's really, honestly, it's really, really good.
And before we let you go, as we always do this too, sorry, we could put you on the spot here, but you are the TLS's fiction editor. What are you reading at the moment or really looking forward to reading?
Well, I am reading at the moment on a African theme, actually. I'm reading about Biafra, a memoir about the Biafran War called There Was a Country by the Nobel Prize-winning Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe, which is very, very good and very, very informative. And I think after that, I'm going to read Half a Yellow Sun, because that's also meant to be fantastic Biafran War novel.
It is. It's a wonderful,
There you go. You've read that. Yeah. So yes, I'm sort of I'm in Biafra at the moment, which is pretty grim. I mean, I don't. It sounds a bit glib for me to say that, but it's anyway. It's been a very interesting experience. And after that, I don't know what comes next.
No, after that,
you have to come back on and tell us.
Okay, you abandon yourself to the carousel of literature and see what comes up, Toby. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about what is fascinating, what we started discussing as a kind of, you know, fascinating piece of literary intrigue, but in fact is, as we've said, a really sad story and a really cautionary tale about how books and about how authors are treated. And we really appreciate you enlightening us on it.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to George Berridge and Toby Lichtig.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.